Hey veterans, one quick note before today's show. I'd love to know how I can better support you in the veteran community. If you have any suggestions, it could be a guest or a guest type you'd like interviewed, it could be a particular challenge you're facing that doesn't currently have a good solution, or it could even be data you'd love to be investigated. Whatever it is, drop me a line at beyondtheuniform.io or on email at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, and I'll do my best to help out. Thanks and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 57 with Alex Peterson.
And one is the uncertainty. I mean that at a macro level in the sense that at any day the company could die. And I mean that at a more micro level in that you don't always know what to do. You don't know, should I spend the next 15 minutes calling back a customer, or should I spend it talking to a developer about the next product release, or should I spend it strategizing an investor fundraising strategy? And there's almost never an obvious answer. And so to say that you're in a world of uncertainty is probably an understatement.
The top two reasons to listen to today's episode are, number one, startups. After just 1 year at Google, as well as only 1 year out of the military, Alex dove headfirst into an early-stage startup as the COO of Polco. He provides some great perspective on how life at a startup is different than life at Google, and how they're more alike than you might think. Number two, funding. Alex has had a front-row seat for Polco's fundraising journey. He provides a great breakdown of the different types of funding available for entrepreneurs and advice for veterans seeking to raise money for their own venture. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, there are other episodes, show notes, ebooks, business directories, and more. Now let's dive in to my interview with Alex Peterson. All right, well, joining me today in San Francisco, California is Alex Peterson. Alex, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks, Justin. Happy to be here.
So quick bio for our listeners. Alex is the Chief Operations Officer at Polco, an early stage startup that is a political participation platform for local governments. He started out at the Air Force Academy, after which he received his Master's of Public Policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served for 7 years as an Air Force officer before transitioning directly to Google, where he worked on strategy, planning, and analysis. And so, Alex, to kick things off, take us back to the moment you decided to leave the Air Force and how you approached that decision.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if there's actually a specific point in time when I can point to that I knew one way or the other that I was going to, you know, stay in the Air Force for a career or not. I guess my calculus was always sort of I was going to stay in the Air Force until, you know, it didn't seem like at least at the moment, it wasn't going to be the right thing going forward. And, you know, my time in the Air Force has been, you know, undeniably, I think, the most rewarding and beneficial that I've had professionally. But at the same time, I think there was a lot of things that I kind of wanted to explore outside. And you know, the Air Force and the military is a fantastic experience. You know, it was a tough decision to make, but I think it was... There was a lot of things that I wanted to try to do that were outside the military, and I think that's ultimately what kind of pushed me in that direction.
And how did you approach that first job search? How did you go about figuring out what you might want to do, what sort of industry and what sort of role, and what ultimately led you to Google?
Yeah, so I guess initially there's a couple of those junior military officer type recruitment programs where you know, you can, some are application based and some are sort of open, but there are organizations that'll work with military officers and enlisted personnel in some cases too, who are looking to transition to the private sector. And I started out a couple of conversations with them, and they did a really good job sort of giving me the lay of the land. You know, this is kind of what the private sector is, and this is how businesses typically work, and these are the different industries that you could be in, and the types of jobs that you could have within those. And I think that survey was super helpful. I ultimately decided, you know, initially that I kind of wanted to do something that was a little more consulting or business strategy related, just to work through, you know, a high level overview of business before I dove into something too specifically. And I ended up actually applying directly to a number of companies rather than working through those recruiting firms. But what I would say, you know, is that even though I apply directly to companies, I know a lot of folks that have gone through those organizations, and you know they've been incredibly good resources, and ultimately made those folks really successful too. So you know, I don't know if there's a right way to approach the job search, but maybe certainly pursuing a couple different avenues at least initially before you settle on one that seems to work for you.
Do you remember any of the ones that you looked at or worked with or would recommend people check out?
Yeah, I was working with Cameron Brooks, and they were great. I, you know, all extremely positive things to say about them. Very helpful. You know, no matter where you are in your process, whether you know you're 2 or 3 years out or you're 3 months out, you know, just extremely helpful. And you know, it was for me, it was sort of a brief conversation with them, and largely that was just because I think I had a few specific companies in mind that I wanted to work with. And my impression was that there was some value in going directly to those companies because I wasn't sure that, you know, that the Cameron Brooks or some of the other firms worked with them. But, you know, again, I know probably a half a dozen people that have ended up in some pretty amazing places, you know, all around the country and the world working through organizations like that. So,
yeah, it does seem like a nice way to get the lay of the land really efficiently for people who are used to dealing with veterans. And even if you don't go that route, it seems like it's a nice way to expand your horizon, and it's, you know, pretty efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they do have some great interview prep, and they'll bring you to conferences where there's other companies that are, where there are companies that are doing recruiting events. So, yeah, it's a great way to go.
And then you mentioned you had this list of companies. How did you even identify the companies you would want to work with? Was this things that you had read about? Was it that you knew people that worked there? Or how did you put together that initial list?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was kind of a combination of two things, really. One was talking to people I knew that had either recently gotten out or were thinking about it and sort of picking their brains for, you know, what industries or types of jobs they wanted to go into. And then the second was just doing research, right? You know, what are the cool companies to work for? What industries, who's, you know, trying to do things that, you know, really have some awesome impact on the world or on society, and then kind of narrowed it down from there. But, you know, I'd say I started out with a pretty exhaustive list before I really started to kind of whittle it down to the few that I ultimately applied to.
And did for Google, did you just apply directly on their website, or how did you land that interview process?
So I did. I applied online, which is, I guess, having now worked on Google's hiring teams, I know that that's not extremely typical for folks to do. Usually there's like a referral, and you know, I'd encourage for any job, if you can get a referral from someone that works there, that's probably the way to go. But for me, yeah, I kind of just threw my name in the hat, and things played out nicely.
And for that role, that starting role at Google, how would you explain that to another veteran, what you did and what your life looked like at Google?
Yeah. So if you can imagine, Google is growing extremely quickly and continues to, despite sort of its, you know, relatively large size in the tech space. And in order to do that, they have to hire quite a few people every year. And in order to do that, there are teams of recruiters and researchers who try to understand, you know, where the talent is in the world and you know, how best to recruit and what makes Google great, and communicating that and the vision. And there's a lot that goes into the whole hiring operation. And I was actually on a support team to that organization that was running a lot of the analysis that kind of drove all of that. So, right, where in the world do we think the talent is going to be in 4 or 5 years, or where do we think it is now? And, you know, how can we get some of the best people in the world to work at Google? Those were some of the questions that we tried to answer, right? Do we think we can get the people that we want to get, given, you know, kind of an increasingly crowded marketplace for talent, for software engineers and salespeople and leadership. And so it was sort of on the analytics side of all of those operations.
And I always think it's helpful to go on to the granular kind of day in the life. And I imagine there was no typical day in the 15 months you were at Google. But if you were to just extract and kind of paint that picture of what did a typical day look like? Like, what time did you get in and what sort of activities did you do?
Yeah. Yeah, so I usually got in at about 7:30 or 8, sometimes a little bit later, and that wasn't that was probably about average. Some people got in earlier, some later. Google's pretty flexible with its hours, as long as you're kind of getting what you need to get done, and if there's any meetings that you're there for those. But so my day was usually spent helping out either individual people or teams with either short or long-term projects. So it could be something as simple as, hey, how many people do we think are going to graduate this year and become software engineers? Or it could be something extremely complex, like in 3 or 4 years, how do we think the landscape is going to change for talent in the Northeast section of the United States? And so obviously some of those can be kind of quick things you can look up. Some are much longer, and we sort of relied on a combination of Google's own data and some external data that we had to kind of crank through the analysis on that and ultimately make some strategic recommendations. So, on a daily basis, absolutely correct. There's not a typical day, but some combination of kind of nose to the grindstone analysis and then brainstorming with other folks about how to approach problems or presenting findings to decision makers, sort of anything in that space, probably pretty evenly distributed throughout the day.
And you already gave one piece of advice of encouraging people to try to get a referral if they're applying to Google. I'm wondering if you have any other advice for a veteran listening who would want to work at Google or a company like them, in terms of how to apply and how to try to get that job offer.
Yeah, so I would say, there's a lot of resources out there for kind of understanding what a company is looking for, both in terms of, the talent, the experience that you have, the capabilities and the drive and your personality and all those things. And Google's no exception. So, in some cases, a lot of that is listed on a company's website. In other cases, you can kind of dig through some forums online and get a good sense for, what a company is like to work for and what specific jobs are like and what the interview process is like. And I think kind of, doing that research ahead of time, it probably does two things. One, it probably calms some of the nerves going into, an interview process. And the second thing, I think it really prepares you to, do as well as you can. Because those things are initially unknowns, but they don't have to be. No need to leave those things up to chance if you can do some research and learn about them, I guess.
And another question I often get is about postgraduate work. And you had already obtained your graduate degree while on active duty. I'm wondering if you thought of getting another degree afterwards, or if you knew you wanted to go straight into industry, or any advice you'd have to other veterans about postgraduate work.
Yeah, so I guess unfortunately, I'm going to have to say in this one that I think every case is a little bit unique. What I would say is that my team at Google, about half of us had some level of a graduate degree or some type of graduate degree, but not everyone did. And it didn't necessarily affect the type of work you were doing or the quality of work you were doing. So at least in the case of Google, it certainly wasn't a requirement for me. In my case, it did help. A lot of the kind of the analytic techniques from grad school or things I used on a pretty daily basis, and the experience in general was helpful. But I would say, it's not a requirement. To your question about whether or not I would go back and if I thought about going back to get another degree, it wasn't on my short list of options coming straight out, just because I had, I felt like I'd spent a fair amount of time in the classroom and I kind of wanted to do something a little more operational. But it's not something I've ruled out for the future, I guess. So. Is if I think maybe this is something that a lot of people feel, but every time I think I'm done with school, I kind of get an itch at some point and say, hey, it'd be really cool to, go explore an MBA or maybe dive a little bit deeper into, some field of industry. So still on the table, I think.
That's awesome. How long did it take you to land that first job? I think it's always helpful, especially for people on active duty, to get a sense of how much room to allow for that job search and before starting their first job.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So for me, the process was fairly short. I don't remember exactly what the timeline was, but I think it was, somewhere between like 6 to 8 weeks from start to finish. One consideration though is that I think in the private sector, it's typically much more common to have, 2 to 4 weeks maybe between jobs. And I think at least for the Air Force, it was something like a 6-month requirement. And if you really crush the out processing, you could do it in like four and a half maybe. But either letting the company know, your recruiter know, whoever it is you're in communications with ahead of time that it could be a longer process, or initiating the transition out of the military first and then starting the application process. Obviously, the latter option is a little bit more stressful because you're saying, hey, I'm going to get out, and not exactly knowing where you're going to be. But I would say, that disparity in timing is definitely real.
And what was it like making that decision to leave the certainty of Google for an early stage startup? How did you arrive at that decision?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think every other day I get up and I'm sad that there's not a wonderful Google Cafe for me to go to, for coffee in the morning in a beautiful workspace. I think it's something I've always wanted to do, is to do an early stage startup. And I think it was the opportunity probably presented itself a little bit earlier than I would have wanted. I loved what I was doing at Google. I still, keep in touch with the team, and there was absolutely no negative about that experience. But Polka was kind of in a spot where it was starting to get some traction, and it was, we're raising money, and I knew the CEO and the founder quite well, so everything sort of lined up in a way that if I was going to take that risk and as you said, leave the certainty of a great company like Google, that that was kind of the time to do it. So it was a hard decision to make, but I think it was the right one for the timing.
How did you meet the founders? Like when did you first meet them?
Yeah, so Nick and I actually were teaching at the Air Force Academy. So my last 2 years on active duty, I was brought back to the academy to teach, and I was in the political science department, and he was teaching econ. And so we were kind of just down the hall from each other. We actually met because there was a textbook salesperson in the hallways trying to sell textbooks, and I think Nick was tired of talking to him, so he walked him down the hallway and just dropped him in my office. And after the textbook salesman left my office, I kind of walked back to Nick, and I was like, "Hey, what the heck was that about?" And we started talking. He's a really good guy. He's kind of just playing a joke on me. So yeah, that's kind of how it started.
That's awesome. And what would you want listeners to know about? Am I saying that right? Is it Palko?
Polko, yeah.
Palko.
It kind of depends on where you are in the country. In Texas, they say Polko, but we usually say Polko. So we work with local governments to help them better connect with their citizens and residents. So, I think most people probably haven't been to a town hall meeting, but those that have know, it's typically 10 to 15 extremely passionate people. Sometimes those passionate people are very much representative of the larger community, and sometimes they're not. And most local governments, especially in smaller cities, just don't have the resources to know what their constituents think. Right, they can't afford the Gallup polls or the national level polling that large organizations and large governments can. And the other options they have are generally not very reliable. SurveyMonkey's fantastic, but you don't know really what the reliability of those responses are. And so we help them sort of get a pulse for what their communities think. And then we do some cool analytics on the back end, and ultimately give them what we hope is extremely reliable and insightful data to help them drive decisions.
And when you first joined them, how big were they? How many employees, and where were they at in the funding cycle?
Yeah, so there, let's see, there was four full time and a handful of interns, plus some contractors on the tech side. So our developers at the time were mostly contracted. And let's see, I think it had raised probably about 150 to 200,000 in funding. And now we actually are just about to close the $500,000 round. So, we're thankful to kind of have a little more traction and runway to kind of keep up our operations for now an extended period of time. So we can actually do some medium and long-term planning, which is really nice.
That's awesome. And it sounds like one of the factors that really helped you evaluate this opportunity was having a strong relationship with the founding team. I'm wondering any other advice you would give veterans about how to vet and evaluate an early stage startup and know whether or not it's safe enough to join or worth leaving a very secure job, whether it's in the military or in a different field, to join something very, very fragile in early stage?
Yeah, so I think there's usually kind of four buckets that I think of it in. There's the team, the market, the traction the company has, and then the idea itself. And you know, you can kind of stack rank those things in any way. But from the perspective of somebody joining a company, obviously the team is extremely important, especially if it's early stage, you know, three or four people, sometimes even smaller than that. And these are folks that you're going to be working extremely closely with in a very high risk, sometimes high stakes environment, and it can get stressful. So making sure that not just that you believe in the people, but that you operate in ways that are complementary to each other. You know, there's a lot of different ways to approach an early stage startup. And usually that represents itself in sort of a culture of a team, and having that fit, I think, is extremely important, would be the first thing. And then, kind of the market and the traction, I would say, are two separate things, right? If you, in general, if you're thinking about, trying to build a successful company at an early stage, it's important that there's a large addressable market, right? If I build, I don't know what a good example is. If I build sweaters for dogs that weigh fewer than 2 pounds, and that's the only thing that I'm going to make, it might be a great idea. And it might be that everyone with a dog that's fewer than 2 pounds wants one of these sweaters. But if that's all I make, and that's all I can make, the market's not very big, and so there's not that much upside. So, you know, maybe making sure that the market that the company is trying to address is something that, you know, you can grow into as the company scales. And the traction is similar to that, right? How much have they proven the proof of concept? Does the product work? Does the idea work? Are they generating revenue? Or if not, you know, are they generating users if it's sort of a software type platform? So those questions are important too. The idea I think kind of listed as the fourth one, and I would say that is important. It's probably especially important later on, but ideas can change, I think. And if the team is good and the market is there, you know, the idea might change over the course of the first six months, year, 2 years, even of a company, to kind of adapt to what the team sees as the best opportunity. So, yeah.
And I'm just curious about the contrast of going from such a massive company with tens of thousands of employees to a company with four or five employees. What were some of the biggest differences that you found in life at a startup versus where you were at before with Google?
Yeah. So one thing I would say is that Google is big, but it still feels very small. It tends to be, the culture is very autonomous. Teams are generally quite small. You know, to the extent that there's a strict management structure, and there's not, oftentimes not, it's really a large organization, right? Your boss might have four or five people under them, and you tend to work quite closely. So, kind of at the narrowest scope, it doesn't feel too different. What I would say does feel different is the amount of impact that each person has, which is kind of outsized at a smaller startup. Right. So, you know, if I do something, you know, incredibly good or incredibly bad at Google, you know, it's noticed, and it reflects on me one way or the other, but ultimately it's probably not going to change, you know, in any significant way, the direction of the company. Right. Google does well because it aggregates all the successes of people up to the top, but you know, for any given person, it's tough to really, associate their actions with kind of the final outcome. But in a startup, you know, if you have four people, and the work is distributed evenly, everyone's responsible for 25% of the outcome of where the company is. And that can be pretty significant. I think that's probably the biggest difference.
And how would you explain your role as COO at an early stage startup? What does your role look like?
Yeah. So one thing I would say is at startups, you know, everybody's kind of doing a little bit of everything. There are so many functions that need to happen, and it's everything a large company has to do, a startup has to do, just has to do with fewer people, right? Yeah, you need folks on, if it's a tech company, you need folks on the tech side doing development. You need someone doing marketing and sales and finance and accounting, and you have to raise money from investors and all these different things, and you kind of divide them up smartly among the folks that you have based on those strengths. And so it is sort of, you know, a not a random, but a wide assortment of activities. But As the COO, I view my role as making sure that the company is moving forward. That means making sure that our fundraising operations have everything they need, that the accounting, everybody's getting paid on time. We don't have to worry about those things because the company really needs to be moving in it. It's kind of about coordinating and motivating the team and making sure that there are no blockers to us really driving as hard and as fast as we can.
That's awesome. And you had kind of talked about that day-to-day life at Google. What is your day-to-day life like look like right now?
So we're still sort of a distributed team. The company's actually based out of Madison, Wisconsin. I'm still in San Francisco, and some of the developers that we work with is also out here on the West Coast. But I would say my day to day is even less consistent than it was at Google. So right, it's a combination of phone calls with potential customers and brainstorming ideas for future product developments, or doing a focus group or a customer discovery meeting with a new customer segment. Sometimes I'll try to dedicate 2 or 3 hours to learning something that I know I need to know 3 or 4 months from now. Like, how the heck does a startup do taxes? I don't know, but I need to find out. So I might dedicate some time to that. It's kind of all over the place. I would say if you like having a lot of things on your plate at once, then early stage is a great way to go. If you're the kind of person that needs to or likes to drill down into one very specific area, then early stage might be the right move. But I would just make sure that the team you're getting on is that's the right fit.
What's it like being part of a distributed team? I'm wondering how you, what you like about that and dislike about that, and how you stay in active contact with your teammates.
Yeah, so I think that there's some benefits and some not. So obviously the biggest potential issue is communication can be challenging. The upside is that because we're geographically distributed, it gives us access to a lot of different things that we may not have if we were in one place. So right, especially because we work with local governments, and it's great meeting in person. I can kind of cover the Western United States and fly around in a way that's a little bit easier than maybe if we were all on the East Coast, say. And the communication problem, we don't have too much. I do travel a lot back to Madison, where most of the team is. So it gives us the opportunity to work in person and kind of sync up on a pretty regular basis. But the technologies that exist now to do remote teamwork are great, right? Slack, if anybody's used it, is sort of a chat room based communications platform that's ideally designed for small teams that are distributed. There's just so many good ways to keep everybody in good comms and kind of on the same track and strategies and planning all aligned that it's probably much easier now than it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
And one of the things I was wondering about just now is I think it's helpful for veterans who are thinking of joining an early stage startup to get that tangible feel for what it's like. And I'm imagining that going from the Air Force to Google, it was either a step up in salary or it was at least the same. But I would also imagine that if you're joining a company that had $150,000 in funding at the time, I'm betting that you either were willing to forgo a salary or it was a pretty significant step down in terms of your immediate payment. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think, in most cases, you kind of have to be willing to accept that at an early stage startup, right? And the trade-off obviously being that, if the company does well and it starts to really generate revenue, or maybe at one point it sells, or in the extreme up case, there's an IPO and the company goes public. There's obviously a much larger upside in that case, but yeah, definitely the case that the first 6, 8 months, year can be tricky. You're eating ramen and it feels like you're back in college again.
And you said that they had about 100 or 150,000 in funding when you joined, and you're just about to close in on another 500,000. I'm wondering how involved you've been with the fundraising process and any lessons learned you'd want to pass on to other veterans thinking of going down a fundraising process.
Yeah. So I have been pretty involved, kind of in the strategy and the game planning of the fundraising. Nick, the CEO, has been doing most of the investor facing work and outreach. What I would say is for anybody who's kind of going the fundraising route, to do some research and learn about a couple things, I guess. One would be the different types of ways to raise money, especially for an early stage, right? Whether you're doing it in a convertible note, which is sort of a loan that you can that will eventually convert to ownership or equity in a company. Whether you're doing a business loan from a bank, some venture capital firms will do venture debt, so they will give you a loan and with interest. So there's quite a few different ways, and I think understanding that kind of at the onset helps to develop a good strategy for fundraising down the line. The second thing I would say is try to talk to people you trust that are very seasoned in the either the venture capital or the angel investor realm. So folks that have given money successfully to companies before, because they probably have a pretty strict list of things that they look for in companies and in teams. And, you know, while I wouldn't say that it's always the right choice to guide all of your operations and strategy just to get funding, it can be a really good indicator of how to think about your own progress, right? So if a venture capital firm says, hey, what we're really looking for is $15,000 a month in revenue, and a burn rate, so your expenses are, you know, less than $30K a month, that's how, you know, they measure good traction or early success, then that's just kind of a good ballpark way for you to for sort of frame, you know, what you're doing. And it may be different based on company and market and the product, the space that you're operating in, but kind of, you know, give a nice survey of the space and ask quite a few people those questions. And I think it can be really insightful.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I think one of the things I always encourage people to do when they're thinking that they're going to raise money in 6 months or so is to have that friendly coffee chat with a venture capitalist where you're not asking for money, but you can ask them about the three things that they'd want to see if they were going to invest in you in the next 6 months. And I think that's so helpful because, like you said, there's so many different things that you have to do in a startup, and it's very easy to lose focus and to lose sight of, you know, where you're headed. But if you have those two or three really specific goals, like you said, with revenue or user base or whatever they are, it at least gives you a little bit of a North Star where you know, hey, at the end of the day, that's what we need to be building towards, and kind of help trim away some of the stuff that doesn't really matter or isn't as essential.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And if a veteran is listening to this and they think that they may be interested in life at an early stage startup, what are some indications that they might be well suited for this and might really enjoy it? And what are some counterexamples of things that might show that they might be not well suited for this or might not really enjoy it?
Yeah. So I think there's probably two things that are sort of, at least for me, kind of the dominant qualities of early stage. And one is the uncertainty. And I mean that at a macro level in the sense that at any day the company could die. And I mean that at a more micro level in that you don't always know what to do. You don't know, should I spend the next 15 minutes calling back a customer? Or should I send it or spend it talking to a developer about the next product release? Or should I spend it strategizing an investor fundraising strategy? And there's almost never an obvious answer. And so to say that it's you're in a world of uncertainty is probably an understatement. So I would say number one is definitely kind of a comfort in being able to make decisions and in general sort of live in a world where everything is uncertain. The second, and maybe this is a little bit related, is you have to be okay with the roller coaster of emotions. You know, there have been days, maybe even individual hours, where I have gone from a 10 on the happiness scale to a negative 10 on the depressed scale, just trying to figure out, you know, what the heck we were supposed to be doing. And you know, not every day is like that, but there are days that certainly are. And I think it's, you know, to your point from before, you know, having that North Star and understanding where you're going may help kind of smooth out those ups and downs, but they're still very real.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, I definitely echo that. And just like you said, I think people underestimate the ambiguity and lack of clarity of what to do in a startup, I think people underestimate that emotional factor of just a tremendous amount of highs and lows, you know, very often in the same day, and just going back and forth between those two, and the way in which it shapes your view of your own identity. I think it's a very big thing for people to consider, that it takes a toll on yourself and the relationships in your life, and learning to develop a little bit more tenacity around that was that at least for me was a huge growth area in joining or being part of a startup.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, some of my friends will go out for dinner or for drinks and they'll say, "Hey, are you available tonight? Do you have any work you have to do?" And the answer is, I mean, yes, I always have work I have to do. It's just a question of whether or not, you know, I want to take a little bit of time off to go have some fun and then hang out with some people. So, yeah, I agree.
How do you have any advice on how you try to at least maintain that balance, or try to, when there is always something to do, how do you make sure that there is room in your life for other things?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have the 100% correct answer to that, but I would say as kind of nerdy as this sounds, is block off time for it. You know, say I'm not going to work at all on this Saturday, and turn off the phone and turn off the computer and, you know, go stare at a tree or something, whatever you need to do to sort of step away. I think it's helpful. You know, I think the personality type that early stage attracts, and I think, you know, largely that the military attracts too, are people that are willing to just go, right? Anybody that's been deployed knows it can be 7 days on and zero off. You know, I think it's just extremely important to make sure that you kind of have that time away. And you know, if you've got friends or significant others, they can sometimes help you get there. Just, you know, maybe be willing to let them help you do that. But the other thing I would say too is, apart from sort of just relaxing and getting time away, I found that sort of dedicating time to learning something is also very normalizing. And I don't know exactly why that is. Maybe it's because it's sort of comforting to know that you're getting, you know, ideally you're getting better at what you're doing by learning new things. But it also sort of seems to be a good contrast, sort of a placid contrast from the more chaotic day to day is sitting down and taking the time to, you know, read a chapter in a book, or, you know, take a class online or something like that, and walk away with something tangible that, you know, okay, I learned something from this. That can be kind of nice too, I guess.
I love that. And any specific thoughts on where people can go to learn those new things? Is there a particular site or a particular book or podcast or movie or anything that you look to that's kind of done that for you?
That's a good question. So yeah, a lot of it for me was sort of just looking at books. I usually use Audible, which is the audiobook. I think Amazon actually owns it now, but they have audiobooks for a lot of these, you know, a lot of them are good business books. Some of them are sort of just good, you know, books to read. Like I think Mindset by Carol Dweck is a good one, or Give and Take by Adam Grant. You're sort of these, you know, I call them airplane books sometimes, because it's the ones you see on the shelf in the airport and as you're getting on your plane, and some of them can be hokey, but some of them are really good. And I think, you know, you read a couple and a lot of times they reference each other, and, you know, one can lead to another, and before you know it, you've got a reading list of seven or eight things. And then there are some good courses online too. I think Coursera is one. They have online courses from universities that sort of make their course materials available online for free. So usually for free, actually, not always. But those are great too, if you're looking for something, you know, really specific that's not sort of a general book level knowledge.
That's great. And for listeners, I'll add that to the show notes so you guys can look and see the all the things that Alex has referenced there. I'm wondering, when it came to being COO at a startup, first of all, was your desire to be in operations, or was it more of like, hey, I like these people, I like this company, and what they need is operations, therefore I'll do that?
I think it was both, actually. So, you know, I love the team, I wanted to work with them, and I think that a lot of my experience in the Air Force made me maybe most, you know, of all the things I could be doing, I'm probably most comfortable, you know, helping to coordinate and work with and lead a small team. And that's sort of exactly what this is. And it, it kind of fit the bill nicely. So yeah, I think it was, I kind of got really lucky at sort of both things that I really wanted was a great team and the ability to kind of help steer it. So I've been fortunate for that.
And if a veteran is thinking of going into operations or operations in an early stage startup, what sort of skills do you think that they need to be really successful in that role?
So yeah, I think I'd probably divide those into like the sort of a knowledge base, the prerequisite knowledge base, and then some softer skills. And as far as the knowledge base goes, just a general high level understanding of business is probably a good foundation to have. And it doesn't have to be, you know, an MBA level knowledge, although that certainly would help. There's a couple MBA type books out there, like 10-day MBA or personal MBAs. I forget what they're called, but there's a couple, and you know, you could kind of skim through those and scan through them and see, you know, what your level of understanding is. Do you kind of understand, how any business works, right? And revenue and profit models. And do you have a decent sense for industries or, how to think about accounting and things like that. And again, I wouldn't say that an intimate knowledge of those things is necessary, but at least a high level understanding is extremely helpful, at least for early stage, right? As the company grows, right? Certainly you have to have a better understanding of those things, but you can kind of grow with the company, I think, in a lot of cases. On the softer side of it, though, I think, you know, being able to lead a small team in an extremely stressful situation is not something that that everybody is comfortable doing. But you know, and you know, what I would say is I had far less experience in the military doing this than I know a lot of my friends did, but I think that the military really prepares you well for that. You've got people that are, you know, potentially worried about did they make the right decision, you know, jumping from a stable job to go to a startup, being able to understand how do you motivate that team, how do you improve the way people coordinate and how the team operates and how successfully it's reaching its goals. Those are things that I think, you know, in a lot of cases, veterans are maybe not uniquely positioned, because certainly you can get that in the private sector as well, but very, very well positioned to do.
And as you look back on your transition from the Air Force, what was one of the more surprising aspects of that transition to civilian life? Or put a different way, what did you not know to expect when you were on active duty about what it would be like on the other side?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that this is going to sound a little bit strange. I think that the biggest difference was that it wasn't as different as I thought. At the end of the day, it's still, you're working, you know, hopefully with a great group of people on something that, you know, ideally that you care a lot about. And that's sort of, I think, what the military for me at least was about too. And you know, sure, you don't have kind of the national security mission and that you do in the military. And for some folks, or depending on your job, you may find the civilian world far less exciting than your time in the military. But you know, I think that all the things that I think most people love about being in the military, and the camaraderie and the sense of purpose and the the alignment towards a mission, if that's the kind of thing that you're looking for, I think that there's skills that transfer very nicely to the civilian sector, and you can find all of those things there as well.
I think that there's a lot of really positive habits that we all take away from the military, and hard work and discipline and exercise and just tenacity and a very long list of those things. I'm wondering, is there any habits that you felt like you had to break from the military, or anything that served you well in the on active duty, but it wasn't as helpful for you once you got out?
Yeah, I think, so first of all, I'd say all those things you listed, I totally agree with. You know, the tenacity is wonderful. And, I've spoken to a couple, VCs, the venture folks who, supply startups with funding, and they will often say, you know, we will bet on a veteran almost any day, all other things being equal, because of those things, right? The determination, the tenacity, the drive, the willingness to succeed and be creative and learn things on the fly. So, you know, I totally, totally agree with you there. The one adjustment, and this is, you know, I think folks may think about this a little bit differently depending on kind of their own personalities, but the structure of the military is not prevalent as much in the private sector. It is in some cases, right? There are some companies and some industries where you may have the degree of hierarchy or something similar that you have in the military, but certainly in the tech space, that doesn't seem to be the case, you know, to any significant extent. And I guess what that means is there's a little bit, you have a little more leeway to kind of go explore and take initiative and sort of see what you can do on your own, maybe without asking permission. And I think that, you know, for a lot of folks who are transitioning, for me especially, right, that sounded great to me. I was like, this is exactly what I want. You know, I want to be able to drive hard and go figure out things on my own and not have to worry about, you know, asking six people or send a staff summary sheet to do it. But what I would say is it still took a transition for me. You know, I think there was a couple times when maybe I didn't realize how ingrained that mindset was, and I had to stop and remind myself, like, hey, you know, there is more autonomy now, and you have to be willing to exercise it. Because if you don't, then you're kind of just sitting there waiting, and that's not a good thing either.
And I'm wondering in what ways you felt ahead of your civilian counterparts because of your military experience, and in what ways have you felt like you've had to really work to catch up to your civilian counterparts?
Yeah, so I'll take the second one first. I think that, you know, the ways that I felt like I was sort of running a little bit uphill were in situations where sort of just a general knowledge of business was sort of lacking, right? You know, I don't come from a business background, and, you know, I didn't do any undergraduate really or graduate work in specifically in business. And, you know, I think just being around the private sector, regardless of what industry you're in, regardless of what your specific role is, you know, if you're in the private sector for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you kind of pick up on those things. And so for me, coming straight out of the Air Force, I didn't have those things. And there was a little bit of catch up to play there. But I guess the nice part is that it's largely, you know, a knowledge based thing, which you can, if you're kind of diligent about it and deliberate, and you have some folks who can help guide you, you can make that up fairly quickly. You know, I don't know that there's anything that where I felt, you know, ahead of my peers in the sense that, you know, I don't think that there is a that veterans coming out of the military sort of have a net positive over folks that have been in the private sector for their entire careers. But I think there maybe were specific things that that were really, really helpful. And you touched on those before, right? Sort of the willingness to work for, you know, 12, 13, 14 hour days if you want to, and really kind of drive, you know, a project or a team to until it succeeds. You know, certainly there are folks, many, many, many wonderful people that have, you know, started out and still in the private sector that have all those qualities. But, you know, I think that was something that I definitely brought specifically from my time in the military, and it was definitely helpful.
Yeah, I think that's refreshing to hear too. And I think a few others, but not a lot have mentioned something similar to that on the show is, I think that there's a segment of the veteran population that approach their initial job search with a thought that they're significantly ahead of their counterparts who have been spending the last 5 to 7 years or longer honing their craft in their field. And I think it's just a healthy approach to enter into this, assuming that these people are just as smart and capable and that they have been working at their job for longer than you have. And you can certainly close that gap and you can certainly be very successful, but to approach it assuming that you're ahead in many ways, I think is probably not the most helpful approach in that.
Yeah, I think that can be tricky, I think.
Well, I always like to leave the last question to have it more open-ended, and I appreciate all the questions you've answered from my part, but I'm wondering, what did I not ask about that you would want listeners to know, either about personal life or professional life, or any final words of wisdom for them?
Yeah, I think maybe the one thing is if you can find someone to sort of think through this whole process with you, you know, maybe someone that's still in the military and is thinking about getting out, you can kind of bounce ideas off of. I think that's extremely helpful. And you know, even even someone, you know, like me that has already transitioned is probably less valuable than an immediate peer that is in the same situation. You know, I was really fortunate to have a couple close friends who were kind of going through the same thought process around the time that I was. And, you know, two of them got out with me and two of them stayed in. But we all kind of helped each other thinking through it. You know, what does it mean if we decide to stay in? You know, what are some cool options for us in the future in our military careers? And if we get out, you know, what could we do? What should we do? Where do we want to be in the world? What kind of company do we want to work for? And I think having that foundation is extremely, extremely valuable. So, you know, I think the things like this and, you know, being able to connect with other veterans who are thinking about transitioning is a great way for to kind of develop those networks, but definitely a very helpful thing to have.
Awesome. Well, Alex, thanks so much for joining me today, and thanks for all the advice for fellow veterans.
Yeah, thanks, Justin.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. As we wrap up, I wanted to share three quick but important announcements. First of all, if you haven't already, please sign up for my newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io. Although I publish on LinkedIn and Facebook, I'll be starting to use the newsletter as my primary means to share new articles, episodes, and resources relevant to the veteran community. Second, I would love to hear from you. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a relationship where I do all of the talking. You can view me as your very own dedicated resource to help you and other veterans in your civilian career. Have feedback on what I can do differently? Let me know. Someone in particular you want me to track down for an interview? I'm all ears. Know of another way that I could help the veteran community? I'm dying to know. You can find me on LinkedIn, comment on any post at beyondtheuniform.io, email me at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, or if you're in the intel industry, I'm sure you can track me down in some super creepy way. However you do it, take me up on it. I thrive on feedback. Lastly, a quick plug for a few resources I think would benefit any veteran. American Corporate Partners and Service to School both provide free assistance to any veteran. American Corporate Partners pairs you with a mentor in your desired industry, and Service to Schools finds a mentor at a suitable undergrad or graduate school program to help you with your application. Check them out. As always, tons of great content and resources available at beyondtheuniform.io. I'm Justin Nasiri, and I'll be back soon with more great episodes.